a lot of people were dropped. On Westside Altadena, 4 months before the fire, many homes, they were dropped. You know, there's State Farm and other insurance companies. To me, they also are predatory of what's going on because they are not paying. Some folks have been paying insurance premiums for 20, 30, 40, even 50 years. And now when it's time to pay out, they're not doing it. They're not paying out. They're making people pay first and reimburse. And how are we, if you lost everything, where are you coming up with the money to pay first when you've been paying these premiums for years? So this is also a hardship.
We're going to do a part two of this discussion, but what do you think is the most important takeaway? Andy, you were making a film. You got a message from your cross the street neighbor. Your house has burned down.
Yeah, I was in Europe at the time, and I just thought, I have lost everything. But if I don't film right now, there'd be no way to transform this experience into something meaningful if there's a meaning to be found. And I found that silver lining with the community. The community has come together out of this, and we stand together and demand that Southern California Edison bridge families over so that they're not pushed off their generational land.
They have an emergency fund of billions of dollars.
Billions of dollars, and they just need to advance money now, and that's part of our petition as well. So this is really something that, you know, it's I made the film extremely fast because it's an emergency response. It's an urgent situation in our town.
We're going to continue this discussion and post it online at democracynow.org. I want to thank you, Andy Timoner, director of All the Walls Came Down, the film shortlisted for an Oscar, features Heavenly Hughes, who founded My Tribe Rise. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Silverton People for Peace and Silverton Grange. Presenting the 23rd Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 19th at 6 p.m. The event will include a community potluck, a keynote speech by PCUN Director Reina Lopez, sing-alongs, and poetry readings relevant to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s mission of social justice. More info available at grange.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the victims of the Border Patrol shooting in Portland are released from the hospital into federal custody.
Portland police officers are under investigation for supporting the ICE murder of Renee Good and punching a protester in the head.
And Washington now boasts the highest minimum wage in the U.S. at over $17 an hour.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 12th, 2026. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Anna Wilcox. The two victims of the Border Patrol shooting in Portland last week are released from the hospital. Luis David Nino Moncada and Yorlenis Zambrano Contreras are now in federal custody. OPB reports that Zambrano Contreras was transferred to the Northwest ICE facility in Tacoma, Washington. She faces charges of illegally entering the United States. Nino Moncada faces charges of aggravated assault and damaging federal property. Nino Moncada admitted to backing a red Toyota Tacoma pickup into an unmarked federal vehicle while trying to flee Border Patrol officers during a traffic stop. OPB reports that six Border Patrol agents drove in four unmarked cars when they identified the pickup, which they thought belonged to Zambrano Contreras. The agents conducted a traffic stop in the parking lot of Adventist Health Portland Hospital. They said they identified themselves as law enforcement. Oregon Capitol Chronicle reports that A nearby camera did not capture footage of the parking lot. The Border Patrol officers were not wearing body cameras. Nino Mancada maneuvered the Toyota Tacoma back and forth while trying to flee. FBI Special Agent Daniel Jeffries told OPB the driver was, quote, striking the Border Patrol vehicle several times. The FBI is investigating the case. A Border Patrol agent told the FBI that they were afraid the pickup would hit them. One Border Patrol agent took out his weapon and fired toward the ground. Another fired toward the driver. Border Patrol agents shot Nino Mancada in the arm. Zambrano Contreras was shot in the chest. OPB reports that the Border Patrol agents told the FBI that they did not know whether the two victims were shot when they drove away. The victims called 911 minutes later after driving 2 miles to the Brea apartments. From there, they were taken to the hospital for medical treatment. Nino Mancada has a court hearing Monday afternoon.
A Portland police officer has been reassigned after he was filmed vocally agreeing with the tactics used by federal immigration officers when they fatally shot a Minnesota woman last week. In a video posted to TikTok over the weekend, an officer is heard telling someone that, quote, sometimes criminals get shot if they threaten a cop, end quote. The video was filmed outside the Portland ICE facility. An unidentified person asked the officer if he would have shot Nicole Good, the woman killed by a federal immigration officer, in Minneapolis last week. The Trump administration has alleged Good was a domestic terrorist who was attempting to run over the officer, but video taken of the incident and witness accounts have disputed that. It was not clear if the Portland officer had seen footage of Good's killing, but he responded saying he would shoot, quote, if she drove a car at me, yes, end quote. Portland Police Chief Bob Day confirmed that the officer in the video has been reassigned to other bureau duties while a complaint related to it has been reviewed. Portland Police did not provide the officer's name. Another Portland police officer was caught on camera repeatedly punching a protester outside the ICE facility in the head while they were already pinned on the ground. Police confirmed that use of force is always under review. Since Thursday, hundreds of Portlanders have attended vigils and protests in support of those impacted by violence from federal agents.
As of this month, Washington's minimum wage is the highest in the nation at $17.13 an hour. Advocates say this increase is the result of years of advocacy on the part of working people and an important step to counter the rising unaffordability in the state. Isabel Charlet has the details.
Washington's minimum wage is once again the highest in the country at $17.13 an hour, and advocates for working families say it is worth celebrating. 19 states raised their wage floors this month, but Washington is one of only 6 with hourly minimum wages that top $16. Jeffrey Gustavson with Firelands Workers United says there's an affordability crisis across the country, and raising the minimum wage is an important tool to counter it.
It ensures that people in the food industry and restaurants, retail, are able to keep up with rising costs at least a little bit. The minimum wage isn't the full solution, but something that Washington should be proud of and that working people fought really hard for.
Washington state voters passed an initiative in 2016 to raise the state's minimum wage and tie future increases to inflation. Gustavson acknowledges the state has taken other steps to improve affordability, like implementing a capital gains tax and a rent stabilization bill. But he says more needs to be done. Critics argue that mandatory wage hikes place a burden on small businesses, leading to higher prices and job cuts. Gustavson says this argument doesn't hold water. He says history has demonstrated when people get paid more, they spend more, and the economy does better overall.
The big business lobbyist groups, they make this same case every time, predicting doomsday. And then what ends up happening is they continue hiring. And they don't go out of business, and restaurants stay open.
Data show wealth in Washington is highly concentrated in urban areas, especially Seattle. Gustavson agrees there's plenty of wealth in the state, but notes it isn't reaching most working families. He adds a higher state-level minimum wage helps ensure people in rural areas and small towns don't fall further behind. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Community members have an opportunity to testify on a draft ordinance that would prohibit law enforcement officers from wearing face coverings. The Portland City Council Community and Public Safety Committee is holding a 45-minute public meeting tomorrow. The ordinance, introduced by Councilor Samir Kanal, would also require that law enforcement officers have a visible badge and identify themselves. Over 30 people have already given written public testimony online in the city council website. At the time of writing, all comments are in support of the ordinance. Commenters expressed distress over the action of masked immigration and customs enforcement officers who often lack visible identification when detaining individuals. One public commenter testified, quote, "All law enforcement officers, including ICE and other federal agents, should be required to be easily identifiable with visible masks. Facial coverings like masks should be prohibited to increase trust with the public and enhance public safety," end quote. Another wrote, quote, "People living anywhere should not be whisked off the street by unidentified individuals. If law enforcement has cause to detain or arrest someone, they should identify themselves. I support legislation to prohibit facial coverings, require badge visibility, and require identity verification for individuals conducting law enforcement activities," end quote. One commenter spoke in support of the ordinance with changes suggesting that law enforcement should be wearing N95 or KN95 masks to protect the health of those who they engage with. The committee meets starting at 2:30 p.m. in council chambers. More information is available on the City Council website.
The U.S. Senate voted unanimously last Thursday to display an existing plaque honoring the Capitol Police who protected the Capitol during the January 6, 2021 riot. The measure, led by Senators Tom Tillis, Republican, North Carolina, Jeff Merkley, Democrat of Oregon, and Senator Alex Padilla, Democrat of California, was approved quickly with a brief debate. The senators stepped up after learning the plaque, which had been approved by Congress more than 3 years ago, was nowhere to be found at the Capitol. Many House lawmakers have been hanging up replicas outside their office doors. The Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley said, quote, "It's important we be honest with the American people about what happened. It's so important we recognize those who defended our Democratic Republic on that day," end quote. Merkley went on to say, quote, "People know we came back as senators and House members and finished our work that day for the peaceful transition of power," end quote. The plaque was intended to be placed at the west front of the Capitol, where some of the fiercest fighting took place. House Speaker Mike Johnson says the plaque, as constructed, does not comply with the letter of the law. Capitol Police have sued to get the plaque put on display, but Trump's Justice Department is trying to dismiss the lawsuit.
Anti-ICE protests sweep the nation as Trump administration defends actions of the agent who shot a Minnesota woman. The Supreme Court is set to debate transgender student athletes' rights, and Democrats wrestle with a diploma divide. With that story and more, it's Zamon Perez with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It was really important to reassure folks who are scared, folks who are concerned for themselves or their neighbors, and then they are energized for the next steps that they can take to preserve democracy.
Moline, Illinois Mayor Sangeetha Irayaputty joined a wave of events over the weekend, protesting the killing of Renee Good by an ICE agent in Minneapolis. A coalition called ICE Out for Good says it organized more than 1,000 rallies nationwide. Homeland Secretary Kristi Noem continues to defend the shooting, labeling Good's actions as, quote, domestic terrorism, saying Good used her car as a weapon against agents.
That is the definition. That is an act of domestic terrorism. He defended himself and he defended those individuals around him.
Video footage shows Good turning the car away from officers and the ICE agent firing his gun after he was outside the path of the vehicle. Nationwide, ICE has taken 65,000 people into custody, some 600 of them children. Michigan teachers are calling for their release. Kristen Shuttle is a Detroit high school ESL teacher. She says it's painful to see teenagers who follow the law separated from their families and treated like criminals.
They're good kids. They've done nothing wrong. Honestly, if this was 10 years earlier, they would have had access to DACA and have had more protections. So it's just, for me, it's the cruelty.
Tomorrow, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments about the rights of transgender student athletes. A 2020 court case ruled that gay and transgender employees are protected under the Civil Rights Act. A former Boise State University student and a West Virginia middle school teacher argue that should let students compete in sports that align with their gender identity. Sasha Bookert with Lambda Legal says instead, schools are policing the gender of all students based on arbitrary factors.
We're increasingly hearing about non-transgender students and athletes being questioned or accused based on their appearance or their athletic ability, which is, you know, a predictable consequence of laws that encourage scrutiny of young people's bodies and identities.
State legislatures have passed more than 100 laws restricting the rights of transgender people. As the midterm primary season ramps up, Democrats are buoyed by their party's major victories and unexpected strength in special elections. Iowa Republicans failed to get a state Senate supermajority when the first black woman elected to the body won her West Des Moines district by more than 40 points. Kamala Harris won it by 17. But Laura Bellin with news outlet Bleeding Heartland says Democrats will have to contend with the so-called diploma divide there and around the country, with level of education becoming a strong indicator of party affiliation.
White voters without a college degree have been increasingly trending toward the Republican Party. It's the same reason that Donald Trump was able to win Wisconsin and Minnesota and Pennsylvania. The Iowa electorate statewide is predominantly made up of white people without a college degree.
Only about 40% of Americans have a college degree. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview on the upcoming Rewilding Conference, starting January 23rd at Bridge Space Commons in Portland. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 41 degrees. The National Weather Service has a dense fog advisory in place overnight for much of the Willamette Valley, which could make driving difficult. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy, but dry, with a daytime high of 50. Today in history, in 1967, Dr. James Bedford, a psychology professor at the University of California, becomes the first person to be cryonically preserved with the intent of future resurrection. Waking up in the future. He remains preserved at the Alcor Life Extension Foundation. The quote of the day is from Anglo-Irish writer Edmund Burke, born this day in 1729. He said, quote, "Whoever undertakes time to set himself up as a judge of truth and knowledge is shipwrecked by the laughter of the gods."
Native groups in Minnesota set up hubs and a street patrol after the fatal shooting of a legal observer by ICE. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native community members in Minneapolis, Minnesota held a press conference Friday to discuss immediate needs, resources, and plans for community care following the fatal shooting of 37-year-old Renee Good by an ICE agent last week in the city. Members of Native organizations and grassroots groups have set up two hubs in Minneapolis for people to gather and organize. Members of the Native community are also conducting street patrols. Robert Lilligren is the president and CEO of the Native American Community Development Institute and a member of the Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors. He says the Native community does not feel safe with the federal presence, adding they're receiving reports of ICE interactions with Native people and detainment.
As a community, I know we are skilled at protecting our people, protecting our assets, protecting our non-Native people, and their assets. And we've had to do this over and over again, historic.
Nikki Love is the executive director of the Tawahi Foundation and a member of the Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors.
We're all here to keep each other safe. And it's very important that we think about not just as Native nations, but that's very important, right? But also as Native individuals, exercise our sovereign rights.
Leaders say they're working with Native organizations, grassroots groups, and tribal leaders to address the ICE presence in their community. Meanwhile, tribal leaders across the country are raising concerns about ICE activities and the safety of their tribal citizens, including leaders in South Dakota, after the detainment of tribal members in Minneapolis. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keen has more.
A statement from the Office of President Frank Starr comes out of the Oglala Sioux Tribe says he is aware of reports of the detainment of four Oglala tribal members by ICE in Minneapolis. In the report, an Oglala bystander was able to get their tribal identities, but unable to get their names. In the statement, President Starr comes out writes, quote, "All Native people born within the territorial limits of the United States are recognized as U.S. citizens by birth. Because I'm both a tribal citizen and a U.S. citizen, ICE has no lawful authority to detain me." In another statement, Standing Rock Sioux Tribe Chairman Steve Sitting Bear writes, quote, "Our nation is a sovereign government, and our members are not immigrants. We are not subject to immigration enforcement on our own lands." He goes on to say that ICE activity is not welcome or authorized on the lands of the Standing Rock Reservation, and that unauthorized personnel will be escorted from the reservation. South Dakota is not immune from the recent wave of immigration crackdowns, as immigration arrests and operations have been reported in communities across the state in recent months. I'm CJ Keen in Rapid City.
Last week, a former White Mountain Apache police officer in Arizona was arrested, stemming from a 15-count grand jury indictment alleging serial sexual abuse and kidnapping. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, federal law enforcement authorities are now asking for any additional victims to come forward.
Carl Eugene Leslie is accused of sexually abusing and kidnapping three victims while on duty between 2020 and 2023. All are White Mountain Apache, and one is a minor. FBI Phoenix Special Agent in Charge Heath Yonke thinks there's others.
We have to be careful, so I won't be able to talk a lot of specifics outside of what's in the actual indictment. What I can say is we believe there are more victims out there.
Leslie's nearly two-decade career ended in 2024.
There's no preclusion of a victim coming forward, no matter how far it may have gone back. We just need to know who they are and the facts behind that.
Leslie has been assigned an attorney out of Flagstaff who declined to comment. If convicted on all counts, he faces up to a life sentence and a $250,000 fine. I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new report says that despite federal funding being canceled for a variety of clean energy programs and initiatives, Oregon continues to make progress toward the state's climate goals. The report says clean energy is still more affordable than power generated from fossil fuels and calls for state leaders to keep it that way. Isabel Charlet has more.
Oregon is making progress in building its clean energy capacity despite major federal disinvestment, according to a new report. The League of Conservation Voters 2025 report shows 30 states passed and implemented policies to cut energy costs, advance clean energy, and tackle climate change last year. Eliza Walton with the Oregon League of Conservation Voters says the report makes it clear that clean energy is still the most affordable option for ratepayers.
But affordability doesn't just happen automatically. We have to keep going and doing more to make sure that savings actually reach people and not just utilities or large corporations.
The report highlights Oregon's Power Act passed last year, which created a new rate class for very large energy users like data centers, so that households and small businesses are no longer subsidizing those facilities' energy use. Walton also points to Oregon's performance-based rate-making law for electric utilities, also passed last year. It allows the Oregon Public Utility Commission to set targets, incentives, and penalties to align utility company profits with public interest goals for the first time.
Instead of being rewarded for just building more infrastructure, utilities are now expected to deliver outcomes that people care about, like keeping bills affordable, improving reliability, and reducing pollution.
Walton says federal disinvestment from clean energy goals slows down projects, raises costs, and creates uncertainty for utilities, workers, and communities. But she adds it also means state state policy matters more than ever. She says Oregon's progress shows what's possible, although with rising demand, there's still a long way to go to meet the state's climate goals. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
New dietary guidance from the Trump administration puts an emphasis on eating more protein, dairy, and whole foods while shifting away from processed grains. As Nadia Romlagan reports, a dietitian in West Virginia says she agrees with the changes.
The Trump administration recently released its new food pyramid, and an expert from West Virginia is praising its focus on fresh whole foods. She says it's a welcome change that the guidelines prioritize proteins and foods rich in omega-3s. Kristen McCartney, registered dietitian and public health specialist for the West Virginia University Extension Service, says local communities in the Mountain State, many which are considered food deserts, have been working to improve access to foods highlighted in the federal guidelines.
The more you can get away from processed foods, the better it's going to be. The focus on meats and fruits and vegetables and then whole grains, really, that could help you accomplish that goal.
The new pyramid places less emphasis on processed grains and advocates for avoiding highly processed foods, particularly refined sugar and carbs. According to a USDA report, nearly 90% of healthcare spending goes to treating people who have chronic diseases linked to the standard American diet, which is high in salt and sugar, and nearly devoid of fresh fruits and veggies. McCartney adds the new guidelines will shape school lunches and beyond. She notes the administration will need to focus on how to prioritize protein, fruits, and vegetables within an agricultural system that incentivizes corn and soy production. She says those grains are the backbone of packaged and ultra-processed foods found in grocery aisles.
The dietary guidelines set the priorities not only just for families, but also what's served in schools and other programs like WICs.
Critics of the new food pyramid say it promotes foods rich in saturated fats, contradicting established science that has guided past food policy. This is Nadia Romlagan for West Virginia News Service.
After a year of in operation, New York City's congestion pricing program is proving beneficial. Beyond reductions in traffic congestion, the program is on track to meet or exceed many of the goals established for it. However, this doesn't mean that the opposition or challenges it initially faced are behind it. Edwin J. Vieira has more.
New York City's congestion pricing program is showing long-term benefits after a year in operation. The program tries to reduce traffic by charging vehicles that enter a congestion relief zone in Manhattan. Although it faced significant opposition, data show it's reducing traffic congestion, making streets safer, and exceeding funding targets for the Metropolitan Transportation Authority to make improvements to the city's subway system. Renee Reynolds with the Tri-State Transportation Campaign says it will take more than a year to see the program's impact on citywide air quality.
We need a longer trajectory to see how well we're doing in terms of asthma rates, hospitalizations due to respiratory illnesses and things like that. But we do see measures like the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, and we know that will definitely contribute to better health outcomes in the long run.
Though it's come a long way since first being introduced, congestion pricing isn't quite out of the woods yet. After U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy pulled federal approval for the program, the MTA filed a lawsuit challenging his assertions. Oral arguments in the case will begin later this month. Opposition to the program was much fiercer before the toll cameras turned on. Many complaints centered on this being yet another toll on New Yorkers. In response to these and other criticisms, Governor Kathy Hochul paused the program's start by several months. But Reynolds says the ripple effects of the delay aren't noticeable 1 year later.
Advocates and agency and elected officials alike focus on the real goal, which is reducing traffic and ensuring we're contributing to a more balanced transportation system.
With the program entering its second year, Reynolds notes there are planned increases to the fee in 2028 and 2031 to ensure congestion pricing meets its revenue goals. She believes these increases will ensure the fee remains a disincentive to drive and promote the use of mass transit. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 12, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Anna Wilcox, Josh Salem, and Lizard. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Zamon Perez, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, and Lauren Schmidt. The director of Evening News is also Althea Billings. A podcast of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Anna Wilcox. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're getting a preview of the upcoming Rewilding Conference set for January 23rd in Portland.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The ninth year of the annual North American Rewilding Conference is returning to Portland January 23rd through 25th. The weekend-long event will be a place for people to discuss cultural rewilding, conservation of natural spaces, ecological crisis, along with many other topics. I spoke with Peter Michael Bauer, the Executive Director of Rewild Portland, about the conference.
All right. Would you mind introducing yourself?
My name's Peter Michael Bauer. I'm the Executive Director of Rewild Portland.
So how would you define wild and rewild?
Yeah, it's a good question. It takes me usually like 10 hours to like explain this to people. I have a class called Rewilding 101 that kind of like dives into that. But, you know, elevator pitch, you know, wildness, oftentimes people think of wildness like wilderness, and they have this misconception that wilderness means untrammeled by man, which is like one of the older sort of conceptions of it, you know. Oftentimes because you had like early conservationists here that were coming across landscapes that were super diverse, very abundant in wildlife, and they basically thought that these were humanless landscapes. And so for early on in conservation,